Sounds True presents Insight Meditation, Tape 12, a talk on practice in the world with Joseph Goldstein.
Coming to the end of this course, it's important to consider how we can bring the practice into the activities of our daily life. There's one teaching of the Buddha which stands like a lighthouse on the shore of our worldly activities. When we practice, wisdom grows, and when we don't practice, it weakens or wanes. Wisdom is not something that we get and then have or possess. Rather, it's a quality of mind, a quality of understanding that we need to continuously nurture and cultivate in our lives. One important implication of this understanding is that the same energy, the same commitment, the same awareness that we bring to the formal sitting practice, or possibly to our efforts on retreat, we need to bring to the entirety of our lives. If we don't do this, we again begin to fall into the old conditioned habit patterns of mind. We again start getting lost in the endless thought forms, and our wisdom weakens. So the important principle here is that our life must be our practice, not simply sitting in a certain position. As one Tibetan teacher expressed it, we have to do what we know. So the question to consider now is, how can we do this? How can we accomplish it practically so that it's not simply just another good idea that we think about, but actually becomes a practice for us? The Buddha spoke of three specific fields of training. The first of them is practicing and refining what is called sila in the Pali language, or morality. This means that we strengthen our commitment and understanding to non-harming. This commitment draws strength from two different sources. It draws strength from the basic feeling of metta, of loving kindness, of goodwill. As metta grows stronger in us, sila, or moral integrity, begins to flow naturally. We no longer have the desire to harm people. We no longer want to do things that might harm others, and so we feel ourselves pulling back from those kinds of actions. The second source of commitment to sila comes from our growing understanding of the law of karma, from knowing deeply that all of our actions have consequences for ourselves as well as others. So we practice taking the time to observe what states of mind are being cultivated in the very simple things that we do. When we eat, when we talk, in choosing how we spend our time. What states of mind are being practiced? Is it anger? Is it fear? Is it love? Is it joy? Is it generosity? Is it kindness? In each of these activities, certain qualities are being practiced. This becomes an opportunity for us to observe, for us to investigate. One example of this, which is a very profound and far-reaching practice and is often ignored in our lives, is the practice of right speech. The energy of speech plays a huge role in our lives. Most of us talk quite a lot in the course of a day. And yet very rarely do we stop to consider mindfully either what we're saying, the quality of our minds behind the speech, what the effect the speech is having. The Buddha singled out right speech as being part of the Eightfold Path, part of the path to awakening. So it's not an insignificant arena. When the Buddha talked of right speech, he talked of refraining from lying, saying those things which weren't true, refraining from gossip or harsh speech or useless talk, not speaking divisively about third persons. At one point early on in my practice, I made the resolution that for some period of time, I wasn't going to speak at all about any third person. I wasn't going to speak to somebody about somebody else. And something quite amazing happened. I saw that 95% of my speech was eliminated. And before I made that experiment, I had no idea how much of the time I was engaged in that kind of talk. And it was not that it was particularly malicious or divisive. It might have been quite harmless, but it still very often revolved about some kind of judgment. For that period of the experiment, when I refrained from that kind of speech, it was very interesting to note the corresponding quieting down of my mind. Because I was not giving voice to all those judgments, I found that the judging mind got much less. Judging of others, judging of myself, and it was really quite a peaceful inner state. Sometimes when I'm in a group situation, in a social situation, and I can see a certain impulse to say something, mindfulness, awareness is very helpful here, because sometimes what I want to say, I see to be completely useless, that it has no point at all. When I'm aware in this way, I can let that thought come and go and remain in a peaceful silence. This doesn't mean that we should become rigid in our communication and that we should feel ourselves in a straitjacket of constraint. We want to engage in our relationships with people in a simple and easy way. And at the same time, simply being aware of speech, both as it's happening and even before it happens, when it's still a thought in the mind, can be a very useful technique for bringing greater awareness to this aspect of our lives. Speech is very powerful. It has a very strong influence on our own minds and is very impactful in our relationships with others. It's not by accident that the Buddha singled out right speech and made it part of this path of awakening, of liberation. Another way that we can begin to reflect on the law of karma and how it becomes a source of commitment for us in our practice of morality, of moral integrity, is when we look to see the effects of our actions not only in our own minds, but on other people. This requires a great honesty and truthfulness and an expanding sense of inclusion. We can look at this in terms of the basic precepts, the basic five precepts of non-harming, for example, the precept of non-killing. Have we made this a priority in our lives? Are we committed to this as a value? And it doesn't mean simply not killing other people. This requires a great honesty and truthfulness and an expanding sense of inclusion. Working with the basic five precepts becomes a practice for us in both noticing the consequences of our actions and using that awareness to refrain from harmful activity. For example, we can practice refining the precept of non-killing. How do we apply that in our lives? Most of us would probably agree that we don't go around killing other people. Although just for a moment, consider what this world would be like if everybody followed just that one aspect of this precept, not to kill other people. The world would be a very different place. But we want to take it further than that. Can we have a respect for all forms of life? Not killing flies, not killing mosquitoes, not killing those things that for some reason are not appealing to us. Once I was getting a haircut in a barber shop and there was a fly buzzing around, and then without any thought the barber picked up a fly swatter, swatted the fly, bang, it was dead. And as he was doing this, I had this momentary impulse to shout, "Don't do that, don't kill it, take it outside." Because it's actually possible not to act on those impulses of killing, but to see, is there an alternative? If there's something that is in an inappropriate place, can we move it? Can we remove it? It's not always so easy. This practice is not always so simple. What do we do if we find that termites are eating our house? Or there are insects spreading disease, malaria-bearing insects. And so there are times when we need to consider the totality of the situation and respond with as much wise compassion as possible. If this precept of non-killing is a reference point for us in our lives, though, we begin to search out for possible alternatives, for possible compassionate alternatives. Another precept which works in a very powerful part of our lives is the precept about sexual misconduct. And that means not to get involved in sexual activity which is harmful, harmful to oneself, harmful to others. Sexual desire is a very strong and seductive force in our lives. Very often, it's precisely in the midst of great passion that we most often feel this is what gives our life meaning. We might feel most alive, most energized. And yet there's a great need to be discerning. Passions can be harmful as well as uplifting. And sometimes we rationalize behavior that is actually harmful to others or to ourselves. Sometimes these harmful behaviors may be intentional, driven by anger or resentment or ill will. And sometimes we do harmful actions by simply not paying attention to the situation. This can be on a more subtle level. And so we need to look, what is the effect of our energy on other people? Not simply our actions, but what effect is our energy having? Do we operate, or are we living our lives from a place of inclusion or from a place of separation? Had one situation arise which illustrated this lack of attention and the harm that can come from it. One year when our teacher Deepa Ma came from India to visit America, she was staying in a house across the street from our center. And some friends had been renting the house from IMS, but they very kindly agreed to move out for the time that Deepa Ma would be here. Then it turned out there was a little change of plans, and a few of us wanted to do some intensive practice with Deepa Ma before the regular course began. And so we asked these friends whether she could come a week early. And again, very kindly, they agreed to that. So Deepa Ma came, and everybody was very excited and enthusiastic. She's a wonderful being. She was a wonderful being. We do our week of intensive practice, and then we begin the regular course, the regular meditation course teaching. And about 2 weeks later, the woman of the couple that had moved out of the house came up to my room in the center, and in the most moving way, acted out her perception of what had gone on for the last couple of weeks. And it had to do with our complete involvement with Deepa Ma being here and the arrangements. And not once in all that time did we invite this couple to come meet Deepa Ma, to have tea at the house. And of course, they felt quite hurt. And as she was doing this, tears came to my eyes because I felt so badly that through inattentiveness, this harm had been caused. It was not intentional, and yet it was a certain lack of awareness of the whole situation. So this practice of sila, this practice of non-harming, has many subtleties, many levels. We want to apply it in all the various parts of our lives, so that we actualize this ideal of non-harming in very practical ways. So we can understand and practice sila by looking at the effects of actions on our own minds. We can practice non-harming by looking at the effects of our actions on others. We can also practice sila by looking at the long-range consequences of our actions. We talked a little bit about this previously in our discussion of karma, that our actions all have consequences, depending or based on the motivation of those acts. The complexity is around the fact that sometimes something feels good in the moment, but is actually harmful. Or something might not feel good in the moment, but in the long run be ultimately beneficial. So this again requires looking carefully at the motivations in our mind. It means looking with clear comprehension about the things around us. It requires us stepping out of our little concerns in the moment to see the bigger picture. Because many of us now are increasingly aware of this with respect to the environment. There may be an immediate benefit from an action with long-term harmful consequences. Or the reverse is very often true in practice, where in the moment we may be going through some tremendous difficulty, where it doesn't feel good, and yet by practicing awareness, by practicing discernment and investigation in the moment, the long-term result of what we're doing brings benefit to us. There's an American teacher who is a Buddhist monk in the Thai tradition. He spent many years in Thailand. He's now the abbot of several Buddhist monasteries in England. His name is Ajahn Sumedho. And he said something very much to the point about this training in sila. He said that our practice is not simply following the heart, but training the heart. Very often we have this notion that, well, if I just follow my heart, everything will be fine. But as we become more aware of all the many forces working within us, we see that there are beautiful and loving and noble things in our heart, and there are also other forces. There's greed and jealousy and pride and envy at work also. So it's not simply a question of following our heart, following every impulse, It's a question of training the heart. One of the ways we train the heart is through the practice of sila, the practice of non-harming, the practice of morality, of integrity. This practice brings a great beauty and happiness to our lives. The Buddha spoke of sila as being the true beauty of a person. So often in our society or culture, we become obsessed with the outer beauty of beings. But that's a very superficial quality. The true beauty of a person comes from the quality of their character, the quality of their being. Sila also brings the peace of non-remorse. When we're acting in ways that are non-harmful to others, then the mind is no longer filled with remorse about harmful actions that we've done. And so it establishes in us a deep and enduring foundation of peace. And the practice of morality, the practice of non-harming, also gives to others the great gift of fearlessness. Because what we're saying to all others with our actions is, you need not fear me. I'm not going to do anything that is harmful. So it's as if we give to everyone we meet the gift of trust, the gift of fearlessness. And this is something that's very precious and very needed in the world today. This is the first field of training that the Buddha spoke of. Training in non-harming, refining our understanding of it, exploring the subtleties of it in our lives. The second field of training, both in our formal sitting practice and in our life in the world, is practicing what the Buddha called in Pali, samadhi. Here this means the cultivation of three particular factors of mind. The factor of energy or effort or courage, the factor of mindful awareness, and the factor of concentration. Energy, awareness, concentration. When these three qualities come together, they give a tremendous strength and stability to our minds. The mind is not then easily overcome by the hindrances or by afflictive emotions. So how can we cultivate this samadhi in our lives? One of the ways that's most important is to develop a daily regular sitting practice. To take the time every day to sit in some comfortable meditative posture, to focus on the primary object, whether it's the breath or sounds or sensations, to begin then to open up to all the other aspects of experience, but to have a commitment to the regularity of a sitting practice. You might want to review the very first guided meditation as a reminder of the basic meditation instructions. The practice, of course, is very simple. It's being aware of what's arising in the moment. Through the guided meditations, there is a systematic development of awareness on all the different objects that might arise in our experience. Sitting every day, there's no way to overemphasize how important this is in our spiritual journey. We can also develop samadhi in our daily life through awareness of our body, of practicing being centered in our body, being settled in body awareness. We can do this in the formal walking meditation, but we can also do it just as we move about doing our daily activities. Instead of being lost in thought about what we're doing or what we need to do or thinking about something in the past, can we actually be feeling our body engaged in the activities? This is a very powerful tool in the meditative journey. The Buddha said something very explicit about this mindfulness of the body. He said, mindfulness of the body leads to nibbana, leads to enlightenment, leads to liberation. So again, it's not a superficial practice. It's one that, when cultivated, goes very deep. As you're moving about through the day, engaged in the various activities, getting up in the morning, preparing food, walking to your car, driving your car, walking down a street, in whatever you're doing, can you feel the sensation of the movement? Can you be aware of your body posture? Notice the times of rushing, because that's a feedback that the mind is ahead of itself, that the mind is no longer settled in the body. So use it not as a way of judging yourself, but as a way of again waking up in the moment and coming back. Sitting regularly, sitting daily, awareness of the body. We can also develop samadhi in our daily life by paying attention to the thoughts and emotions that arise. We can investigate what they are. Thought is an amazing phenomenon. We all have countless numbers of thoughts in the day. When we're lost in them, they have an enormous power in our lives. Thoughts arise, do this, do that, go here, go there, and we act out in following these thoughts. And yet, when we bring mindful awareness to the fact that we're thinking, we see that the thought itself has no substance. The thought is insubstantial, transparent. And so there's a tremendous difference between being aware of a thought and being lost in a thought. There was a famous Korean Zen master, I think of the 11th or 12th century, whose name was Shunul. He said, do not fear the arising of thoughts, only be concerned lest your awareness of them is tardy. So it's not that we do battle with thought or struggle not to have them, but rather in the course of our daily life, we want to bring awareness to the fact that they're arising. This gives us the chance to exercise some discernment, which thoughts to act on, which thoughts not to act on. We can become familiar with the particular tapes that arise again and again in our minds, the particular thought tapes that arise. We can investigate and be aware of the emotional patterns. What habits of emotional response arise again and again? How are we relating to them? Are we lost in them, identified with them? Or do we have a spaciousness of mind which allows them to arise and pass away with ease? Sitting regularly, aware of the body, working with thoughts and emotions. In the course of our daily life, we can also tune into the breath from time to time. Simply taking a few minutes. You know, sitting quietly, you have a few moments. Instead of simply letting the mind wander or drift, use that time to reconnect with the feeling of the breath. Opening to sounds is a wonderful practice that we can bring to our lives. Sometimes people think, oh, if I only lived in the country and there were beautiful sounds of birds and the wind in the trees, it would be such a lovely practice. But opening to sounds can be useful wherever we are. I had a very good lesson in this. One time when I was living in India, I was traveling up to Kashmir to spend some time of the summer months in the mountains. And I was on one of those interminable Indian bus rides. It was about a 17-hour bus ride on this old, rattly, crowded, noisy Indian bus. And for the first few hours on this bus, I was sitting there trying to keep everything out, trying to keep all this unpleasant stimulation out, and being with my breath in, out, and struggling to hold on to the breath. But after some time, I realized that I was making myself very tense, trying to hold on to one object and exclude everything else. So at a certain point, I realized this, and I simply opened my awareness to let all the unpleasant sounds and vibrations and noise and smells and the whole experience, to let it all in rather than to keep it out. It changed the entire rest of the journey. Instead of struggling to avoid certain aspects of experience, I settled back into an open and easy awareness of whatever it was that arising. And sound became a very useful vehicle for doing this. The principle here is to let it all in, rather than to keep everything out. In our practice of samadhi, the second field of training, it's important to remember that awareness is not something that's far off or far away. It's not something that we don't have and need to get. Rather, it's that natural quality of mind which we can come back to again and again each time we're distracted. The first field of training is sila. The second field of training is the development or strengthening of samadhi, that is, right effort or energy, mindfulness, and concentration. The third field of training is the development of wisdom, that is, the investigating power of the mind. Wisdom is that quality which illuminates the Dharma. It's like a light in the mind. It illuminates what's true. It's been said that the light of a single candle dispels the darkness of 10,000 years. It doesn't matter how long we've been lost or how long we've been in confusion. As soon as we bring mindful attention, as soon as we light the candle of wisdom, our experience is illuminated. And this wisdom comes both from our sitting practice and also from wise attention in life. We can develop wisdom by paying attention in times of difficulties in our lives. These times are telling us something. We can investigate the cause of the suffering. Where are we getting caught? Where are we getting lost? Is it in a particular reaction to a situation? Can we be with those difficulties without blaming ourselves, without blaming others, but using the power of investigation, using the power of mindfulness to discover the deepest causes, the root causes of that situation of suffering, of that difficulty? We can investigate how we get caught in various attachments. The Buddha spoke of four fields or areas of attachment that we can investigate. The first of them is quite familiar to us, and that is the attachment we have to different sense pleasures. When we look at this, we see that it reveals a lot about the pattern of addiction in the mind. And we don't need to always consider addiction as some life-consuming tendency. We can look at the power of addiction in very small things. Our various impulses to eat. Is it always when it's wise, or is it simply a momentary craving for a sense pleasure? We want to look at our desire for attachment to sense objects with interest, not with judgment. This is not about judging ourselves, it's about discovery. The second area of great attachment in our lives is the attachment we have to our opinions and views of things, our own point of view. It's our attachment to being right. It's very helpful to begin to investigate or see the difference between what we really know from experience and what is simply an opinion. And even about things that we think we might really know, to keep an open mind. The world is quite mysterious and can be understood from many different perspectives. It's attachment to viewpoint, attachment to opinion, which is the cause very often of tremendous conflict in the world. This doesn't mean that we don't have opinions or we don't have viewpoints about many things in our lives, but to the degree that we can free ourselves from this strong clinging to them or strong attachment to them, our minds stay much more open, much more receptive to other possibilities. The third field of attachment the Buddha spoke of was what he called attachment to rites and rituals as being a means for spiritual awakening. In recent times, this has been expressed, I think, in a very useful way by the great Tibetan teacher Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, who was the founder of Naropa Institute, in a phrase that he used, spiritual materialism. That is, when we use whatever spiritual practice we're engaged in as a way of reinforcing separation, of reinforcing a sense of self. We can see this kind of attachment at work very clearly in the extent to which sectarianism is part of so many spiritual traditions, where people become attached to their particular way, their particular path. And the path itself may be fine. It's the attachment to it and the sense of it being exclusively right that causes conflict. Attachment to anything is the cause of suffering. And the fourth attachment the Buddha spoke of is the attachment to the concept of self, which we've discussed in previous talks. We create a sense of self when we become identified with the sensations or thoughts and emotions that are arising in our experience. We create a sense of self through the stories that we make up about experience. We can so easily get lost in the projections of our mind. On one retreat with my teacher Upandita, I was doing some walking meditation outside underneath his window. And I was walking back and forth. I happened to glance up and I saw him looking out the window. And so immediately I slowed down, I became more mindful, at least ostensibly more mindful, lifting, moving, placing, walking carefully, slowly. And after some minutes I glance up again, there he's still looking. And I can't quite figure it out, but I simply go on doing my walking meditation, always with this slight anxiety created by the thought that he's watching me. After 15 or 20 minutes of this, and not understanding why he was watching me for so long, I looked up at the window and I looked more carefully, and I saw that it wasn't Upandita at all. It was a lampshade. And it was such a good example of how very often we create various stories in our minds. Sometimes they're true, sometimes they're not true. Get lost in the story, reinforcing the sense of I, reinforcing the sense of self. We create stories about our spiritual journey. Well, maybe if I practice for 20 years, I'll learn a little something. That's a story. Awareness is happening right now. Wisdom can be developed right now. So how do we investigate this attachment to self in our daily lives? We can watch for the creation of these stories. We can watch for the feeling of contraction in the day, what we could call moments of selfing. We can practice being aware of when this I sense appears. What we want to do over and over again throughout the day is return to the basic simplicity of awareness. In the seen there is just what is seen. In the heard there is just what is heard. In the sensed there is just what is sensed. In the thought there is just what is thought. We return to that simplicity. So wisdom arises from exploring the situations of suffering, of difficulty, of how we get attached in all these various ways. Wisdom also arises from the direct experience of impermanence. And we see this on every level of our experience. Whatever arises will also pass away. A deep investigation and realization of this truth, that whatever arises will also pass away. There is nothing which is permanent, nothing which is lasting, is a powerful liberating force in our lives. It compels the question, what is it that we're holding on to? What are we actually doing with our lives? What is of value? What is of importance? The Buddha made a very startling statement about the importance of seeing impermanence. He said that it's better to live for a single day seeing clearly and deeply the momentary arising and passing of phenomena than to live for 100 years without seeing this. Now, this is really quite a shocking statement about what we choose to do with our lives. The Buddha is saying that it's better to live for a single day seeing deeply into the truth of impermanence than engaged in all of the other activities that we might be engaged in. Because it's through the seeing of that that we plant the seed of awakening. Wisdom replaces ignorance in our lives as we deeply realize the impermanent nature of things. When we realize that a much more lasting happiness comes from letting go rather than from holding on. The Thai meditation master Ajahn Chah, who was the teacher of Ajahn Sumedho, the American monk I mentioned before, said, "Do everything with a mind that lets go. If you let go a little, you will have a little peace. If you let go a lot, you will have a lot of peace. If you let go completely, you will have complete peace and freedom. Your struggles in the world will have come to an end." It is this wisdom of letting go and of non-grasping that allows the heart of love and compassion to open. We see more and more clearly the interrelationship of vipassana, insight practice, and metta, or loving-kindness. We can approach this understanding from two sides. We approach it from the side of developing love and compassion for ourselves, for friends, for difficult people, and finally for all beings, slowly expanding the field of love and compassion to embrace all beings. There's a Japanese poet who expressed this so beautifully. He said, "In the cherry blossom's shade, there is no such thing as a stranger." And we can also approach it from the side of selflessness, that there is no one there to keep anyone out. So we begin to see that genuine metta or loving kindness is the expression of selflessness. And in true emptiness, there is the natural manifestation of love and compassion, that these two are not separate. All of these three fields of training that the Buddha spoke of, the training in sila, morality, the training in samadhi, the mental strength of energy and mindfulness and concentration, and the training in wisdom. All of these can be held and practiced with the motivation of bodhicitta, that true and genuine wish to benefit all beings. Knowing that all our lives are so interconnected, and that how we are inevitably affects all others, we can consciously do our practice and live our lives with the motivation of seeking the happiness and welfare of all. This motivation of bodhicitta opens our lives. It places our struggles and our difficulties in a much bigger context. The inspiration for our practice becomes vaster. As we practice freeing ourselves from greed and hatred and ignorance, the more our lives will of necessity be for the benefit of all others. Our practice is our life. It's not something we do one time. It's not limited to simply formal sitting. You can use these guided meditations and the talks repeatedly to reconnect with the simplicity and the depth of the Buddha's teachings and how they apply to every circumstance of our life. I'd like to close with a teaching from the Dalai Lama, which very clearly integrates our practice and our lives. We are visitors on this planet. We are here for 80, 90, 100 years at the very most. During that period, we must try to do something good, something useful with our lives. Try to be at peace with yourself and help others share that peace. If you contribute to other people's happiness, you will find the true goal, the true meaning of life.
This concludes side A. Please turn the tape over for side B.